Okay. So who's on so far?
Tita and Ken, and Alan Wells is here with us.
Okay, Tina, Ken, and Alan. All right.
Sandra. Sandra's here.
Hi, Sandra.
Hey, how are you guys?
Good. Anyone else?
Hi,
this is Michael.
Hey,
this is Kazue and Masaki.
Hi, everyone. It's Joanne.
All right. Hi, this is Cristiano de Corallo.
This is Bill Barnett.
Sarah's here.
Sarah Joe is here.
Hi, Sarah Joe.
Hey.
Hey, yeah, it's Jeff.
Tom Donaldson on the line.
Jeff and Tom.
Okay. Hi, Rand on the line.
Rajesh, okay. All right, let's just see. Jennifer, Christy Petranko, Blair Coles, Sarah's here. John Hannigan, James Reynolds, Dan Savage, Bill Dunty, Dale Harold, Helen, Leah, Miguel, Mike Studdy. Okay, we'll just have to wait a few minutes and see who else joins on.
This is Claire.
Hi, Claire.
This is John.
This is Scott.
Scott. Well, I wish someone from NIAAA would get on, and then we can officially start. But, all right, in the meantime, a few items. Remember that your RPPRs are due April 1st, which is this coming Sunday. So get those in. Also, email Jill a PDF copy of that final version. You can download it from ERA Commons, and it'll have final written up in the top right corner. And then we need your IRBs and IACUC approval letters, protocol letters, depending upon your project. Second item is that we're going to meet in a face-to-face meeting on Friday, June 15th in San Diego. Right now, we're scheduled between 3 and 9 p.m. I'm not sure if it'll take that long, but the day before RSA officially begins, the fetal alcohol study group begins, so we made it at a time when people from the East Coast can get there on Friday and still get to the meeting. The hotel is about a 10 to 15 minute cab ride from the airport. It's pretty easy. There's a doodle poll about next month about the conference call. There are lots of conflicts, so please try to fill that out. Jill sent that out. And anyone who is considering going to ISPRA, make sure you go to the ISPRA website, click on awards, and you can apply for an ISPRA travel award that's being funded by NIAAA. There's some money, not a tremendous amount, but hopefully we'll be able to help everybody out. And then just to email Jill, or Jennifer, I'm sorry, any new items you have about the CPAS website. All right, so that's that. Anyone from NIAAA on yet? Okay.
Ed, it's Joanne. Could you just repeat again? I'm sorry, I missed your comment about the IRB letter.
Yeah, you need to send Jill your IRB or your IACOC protocol letters so we could keep copies of those.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other issues or questions? Tatiana, are you there? She's on vacation, so she's not going to be doing...
She's not, but I'm here.
Oh, I
Leah.
Called your name before. Are you going to do it, Leah?
Am I going to do what?
The update on the common study elements.
We just got all, everyone's data in, so it'll take me a couple days to summarize it, but I can send something out later next week if you want.
Thank you. That's a great update. Appreciate it. And that's fine. Bill Barnett?
Yeah.
Anything on the external user data access request?
Yeah, we've been trying to get the first one processed. It turns out that he asked for phase one data, and so we're just revalidating with those data stewards that's okay to provide him those data. Other than that, his application is complete, and I think it looks very strong. We have a second one in that is incomplete, and I'm following up with that investigator, someone from the Lagos Hospital, actually a software company. It's a little unclear, but it's not for a profit. But I'm trying to get a little bit more clarity on it from his proposal, a little bit more clarity on what data elements he is requesting. And so we're kind of waiting for that to get to the point where we can submit it to the data access committee for review.
Okay. If Bill was on, Bill Dunty, he was going to tell everybody, this is for the future. In our last renewal, competitive renewal, we were allowed to carry over funds from phase three to phase four. That may be very limited in the future. So if you plan on participating in CFAS 5, try not to have a lot of money left over in your account because it'll simply go to offset any new award that you get. We were very fortunate this time in that few things slipped under the radar. That won't happen again. So I'm just telling you, try not to have really large carryovers every year. Okay. Tina, are you ready to go?
Sure. So we're going to bring up the WebEx here, I think.
I'm sharing my screen.
Okay. Okay. Can you guys see it?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. So I'd like to introduce to the group Alan Wells, who is the primary statistician who's working on the CFAS 4 with us here. What we're going to present today, Helen has helped us out with substantially over the past couple of months. So Our AIM 2 is the thing that we're focusing on here, this risk and resilience profiles based on information that we have archived and will be additionally informed by the markers that we're continuing to explore in AIM 1 to predict performance in kids as they move along. So this is just to review of what was presented at the consortium meeting that we had in February. We developed these individual growth curves using prenatal measures for weight and head circumference and postnatal measures for weight, length, and head circumference for 441 singleton infants. And then we screened some of the clinical variables that were available to see how the addition of those clinical variables along with the growth trajectories improved prediction models for performance on the Bayley scales of infant development. And so as we showed previously, almost all of the weight measures from prenatal ultrasound, head circumference from prenatal ultrasound, and postnatal measures on weight, length, and head circumference were significant contributors to MDI and PDI on the Bayley. and of the maternal variables that we screened, and we tried to select ones that were things that we thought would be readily available in clinical practice, so it would be practical to be able to include these in the model, that many of them, as we would have expected, were also significantly associated with the outcome. And as we showed previously, in building these models using the Bayley as a continuous measure, looking in the alcohol exposed group as the area that we're most interested in, explained variance at 6 months, for example, was about 37% for MDI and 33% for PDI. If we looked at this categorically as a Bayley score less than 85, the area under the curve at 6 months, for example, was about 81% for MDI and 85% for PDI. And as we showed previously, we did see some sex differences in the alcohol exposed group, where the explained variance was greater in these models for males as opposed to females. So the explained variation, as you've seen, let me see if I can move this out of the way. Maybe we can't. Okay. So the explained variation, as we've shown for the continuous measure and the area under the curve for the dichotomous measure, was substantial. The prediction was less robust among the alcohol unexposed group, so we're getting a better prediction model in the alcohol exposed group. And I think it's important to state that this is not all being driven by alcohol exposure. So, of course, the alcohol exposure measures did contribute to the model, but in a model that includes only the growth trajectories, we're still getting a pretty good accounting of variance for MDI and PDI and area under the curve for MDI and PDI with just the growth trajectories. And I think it's also important to continue to pursue the differences in sex in the alcohol exposed group between boys and girls. So let's see if I can make this go forward now. Okay, there we go. So we're extending this work now, and what Alan's going to present, what we've been working on with Helen, is to look at trajectories of alcohol exposure across gestation and to explore how those specific trajectories relate to growth and neurobehavioral outcome. And so what we've been working with Helen on is using this Tableau data visualization platform that's supported by IU and is available to all of us in the consortium. And so what we've done is taken data from the prenatal interviews that capture information at three different time points, so day-by-day drinking, in the week around conception, in the previous 2 weeks at the time of enrollment, and then again in the third trimester, day-by-day drinking for a week if the mother changed drinking from the time of enrollment. And we constructed alcohol exposure trajectories for these 510 individual women for whom we had these data. So the data visualization platform, this Tableau platform, we're using to visualize relationships between these cross-gestation alcohol trajectories and FAS outcomes, growth, and neurobehavioral outcomes. And as you'll see, there's lots of flexibility and opportunities in using this platform to look at it in multiple ways. So what Alan's going to do is give just a little preview of what this looks like by type of alcohol, hours spent consuming alcohol, change in alcohol consumption over gestation and cumulative consumption, and then an example of socioeconomic status and neurobehavioral outcomes. So I'm going to turn it over to Alan.
Sounds good. Yeah, I'm just going to exit this presentation and go into the web browser. Can everyone see this here fine?
Can you guys see it?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay,
cool. So what we have here is on the x-axis, is gestational age, so the course of a pregnancy, and on the y-axis we have absolute ounces of alcohol for different types of alcohol. So when we collect drinking data, we don't just ask how many drinks did you have. We break it down into specific types to get at higher concentrations of alcohol in liquor versus light beer and such like that. So we have two lines here, a red line and a green line, and both these lines represent the two groups for FASD status. So the red line is for kids who were diagnosed with FASD during a dysmorphology exam, and the green lines were children that were diagnosed for FASD. So the mothers and this is alcohol consumption in mothers during pregnancy. So the red line is FAS, yes. So mothers who consume more alcohol were FAS status, yes, as we can see. And, you know, this is consistent across light beer, you know, dark beer, wine. We don't see it across fortified wine, but we don't have a lot of data on women who are drinking fortified wine, so we think that's driving the difference there. But this is just, you know, an overall general picture that, you know, if the mother is drinking more alcohol during pregnancy, you know, that there's going to be a, you know, a higher chance of being exposed, obviously. And this is just showing it over the course of the pregnancy here. So the next one we have showing is actually showing the running sum of alcohol for different types here. So the running sum for, you know, the unexposed group was lower than it was for the exposed group in all these types of alcohol we see here, except for fortified wine again. And just these numbers on the y-axis here are absolute ounces of alcohol. And you can see, you know, for wine and dark beer, this is the average, you know, absolute ounces of alcohol consumed in each group. And you can see the scales, you know, 20, 16, 13 for some of these alcohol types. But the largest contributor to alcohol consumption in this cohort was by far was liquor. And that's just probably just an artifact of, you know, the type of alcohol they drink in that region of the world. But the consumption of alcohol, I mean, liquor specifically, was much greater in this group. And again, this is split by FAS status. So next, instead of splitting it by FAS status, we're actually splitting it by birth growth percentile for different growth measures. So we're starting off looking at PFL. So the orange line here is kids who had a birth percentile for PFL less than 10%, and the blue line is for those who had greater than 10%. And it's just showing that mothers who drank more alcohol, they, you know, kids who were born with a birth percentile less than 10%, those mothers drank more alcohol on average there. And we're seeing this. So each one of these little plots here is a different type of summary measure for alcohol. The first one is just absolute ounces of alcohol per day on average. The second one is absolute ounces of alcohol per drinking day. Absolute ounces of alcohol per drinking hour next, proportion of drinking days, so how often they drank, total number of drinking days, and then total drinking hours. So, you know, whether we're summarizing it by drinking hours, proportion of drinking days, absolute ounces of alcohol, you know, there's a clear separation between these groups being greater than the 10th percentile or less than 10th percentile. And this is just for PFL. So if we wanted to also look at, let's say, height as well, we could also look and see that the separation is still clear for absolute ounces of alcohol per day for kids who were born under the 10th percentile or greater than the 10th percentile for height. And it isn't as clear as a separation in some of these outcomes as it was for PFL. And I'm going to go to head circumference in a second. And the interesting thing is when we look at this for head circumference, the difference you're seeing between alcohol consumption between those in the lower percentiles and the higher percentiles, it's there in the beginning of the pregnancy, but it doesn't continue throughout the pregnancy there. So we have some hypotheses as to why this is happening, but it's just interesting to see these differences when you look at different growth measures here. And finally, what we have here in the next tab is we have these are preschool neuro outcomes, and specifically this is the DOG 2 outcomes here on the left hand side, and we have here different socioeconomic status categories, so, you know, lower being on the left and higher being on the right, and then within each one of these categories we have no and yes, so that's for FAS status. So yes were those kids who were diagnosed with FAS status, and no were the kids who weren't. So we have that split within each category. And just an overall trend, you know, we can see that the outcomes for these preschool neuro measures just generally are better and higher as you go and increase in FES status, which is something that, you know, you would expect. But the interesting thing is that when you look at the differences between kids who were diagnosed with FASD and kids who weren't, the difference is much more severe in these lower SES categories than the difference is when you start to look at these higher SES categories. So just the difference between these two groups is magnified by where you're at in this SES category here. And you can just see by the colors there, orange and red are lower, and blue and gray are higher there.
Were there no children in the FAS group and the highest SES group?
Exactly, yeah. So the highest SES group actually had no FASD diagnosed kids in our cohort.
So as you can see, looking at the platform here, Helen's built in a whole lot of ways that you can slice the data. So that we can do it by whether they were assigned to the vitamin intervention and which group. We can do it by alcohol exposure group. We can do it by sex of the infant and a variety of other factors. Have also plugged in the growth trajectory data for the Z-scores that Alan developed for all of these kids over the repeated measures. And then the next steps, I think, are to include some of the biological measures, such as the microRNA status for these mothers in mid-trimester and third trimester, to see what it is that we can see visualizing it this way. So I think this is a really useful tool, and I think there could be potential other things that other investigators in the consortium could use. So our next step is we're continuing to develop the growth trajectory model, now looking at preschool outcome as what we're interested in. And we're, Claire has been discussing with Sarah and myself a potential approach to looking at the preschool testing battery and how to classify these children with respect to FASD. So what are we going to call an affected child versus an unaffected child, since what we've done so far is basically look at continuous measures and differences between groups by alcohol exposure. So that's the next step for that. And then aim 2C for us is to take the trajectory models that we built through the preschool endpoint and to try to test those in the CFAST phase 2 and 3 data that Sarah has, to see if we can use some of these maternal covariates in addition to alcohol exposure data and see if we can classify kids as well or close to as well using that kind of data.
Tina, can I ask a question? It's Sarah. Can you use this to visualize interactions? Maybe I'm just missing it. But how, like, for example, if you expected that socioeconomic status would interact with alcohol exposure, is that illustrated here?
Yeah. So for So instead of having each SES category split by FAS status, you could have it split by alcohol exposure or split by, you know, another factor that you're interested in, and that's how you can kind of see interactions. And there's actually, I wasn't planning on presenting this, but this thing I'm scrolling down to next is actually perfect for interactions because it's within a high MDI group. It's showing the difference between people who had high and low PDI. So that's the interaction between, you know, MDI and PDI and the mm-hmm. categories we have for dichotomizing them. So you can see interactions in this exact type of format as well, where you're splitting two groups and seeing if there's differences between them like that. So it definitely helps to visualize interactions and patterns that, you know, would be hard to visualize otherwise.
Great. Thank you.
So it's not giving you any sort of statistical test, but it is allowing you to look at it visually. We didn't have time to present the data here, but it's really cool how graphically you can look at growth deficiency by alcohol exposure over time, and you can see it. You can use a time scale and just move the cursor at the top and show how it changes by age of the child.
So the conclusions, which so far, what do you think your major findings have been?
I Mike, I think that our conclusion is that growth is important. Certainly it's important in terms of neurobehavioral outcomes for children in general, but it seems to be more strongly associated with neurobehavioral outcomes in the alcohol exposed group, independent of other factors. And so that's, I think that's where we sit, that it is an important factor.
Right, interesting, now. Given that they've given up using it in some context, and I think it really is important.
Yeah.
Right. It's almost like it's a marker of the brain outcome. Yeah,
it's a marker
of the brain outcome. It'll be fascinating, Tina, to put the cytokines in there when
Absolutely.
We have the same mothers. It would be dynamite to add that in.
Absolutely. So that and the microRNA data, I think we can certainly add those values in and see what we come up
yeah,
with.
Yeah, definitely.
You presented absolute alcohol in a number of different scenarios for drinking occasion. Do you see any cutoff on the lower end that don't appear to have an effect?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So what we're doing with Gretchen Bandley, the new faculty member in our group, one of her specialties is doing these K-means approaches to developing trajectories for, you know, medication use or drug use over pregnancy. So what she's going to do is create the trajectory categories. So maybe there are four or five different sort of typical categories of alcohol consumption that you see across pregnancy, which I think has useful clinical applications as well. So the mom who binge drinks in the first 3 or 4 weeks and then doesn't drink through the rest of pregnancy, the mom who drinks more lower amounts but more frequently but continues to drink sporadically through pregnancy. So those several trajectories, looking at if you're classified in trajectory A versus D, how does this relate to neurobehavioral outcomes and growth? And then I think that's where we may be able to say that we don't see much evidence with a drinking pattern that looks like, you know, mm-hmm. trajectory D.
Mm-hmm. Tina, you have nutritional data on this group as well, correct?
For a subset, yes.
Oh, just a subset.
And that can go in with the microRNA and the cytokine data as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, our goal with this, you know, as we said from the beginning, was to say what could you do with what, you know, pretty much every clinician has at their fingertips.
Mm-hmm.
So can you plug these data into this algorithm and say at birth or at 6 months or at 12 months, how likely is it that this child is not going to be doing very well when they get to be 3, 5, 7 years of age versus how likely is it that they're going to be fine. So the goal was to pick the covariates and available data that would be readily accessible. But then in addition to that, seeing how much better a prediction we'll get by adding these biomarkers, whether it's nutrition, cytokines, or microRNAs, or the combination of those, which would drive, if you're getting a much, much better prediction value out of that, then it would drive a recommendation to say we should actually go to the expense of measuring this in pregnancy.
All right, so I have another question about the SES. The high SES group doesn't appear to have any impact. But is that because they're drinking less, or?
It could be. Yeah, you're only looking at it by SES and FAS status.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It could be less affected, or it could be, you know, they have better access to help. It's, you know, there's a number of reasons why you could guess that they're
yeah.
doing that overall.
Yeah. The drinking measure is the key one.
Yeah. Exactly.
I don't know if you remember Elizabeth Sal proposing that basically to prevent FAS, you had to increase socioeconomic level.
Right.
And
right.
that was a major variable. And from what I see, it's either they're not drinking or it really does matter if you get all the other benefits of being in a high SES group.
Right.
Yeah.
so there's where you can go back to the drinking trajectories that we showed in the beginning and then stratify that by high SES and FAS status.
Yeah,
we can look
exactly. And that's something that I actually think that we can go back and look at it if we have a second. So if you look at some of these different...
The other thing you could do, this is the other thing you could do is try to sort out what are you talking about
with
as part of that SES package that's making a difference.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so if you look at, for example, here we're looking at, you know, kids who were born with a birth percentile for PFL less than 10% or greater than 10%, and we're just looking at the two highest SES categories here. The difference in alcohol consumption between those who had a lower birth percentile and a higher birth percentile is pretty small, right? There's almost no difference there. They're very close to each other. Where if we look at these, so let's say the three lowest SES categories versus the two highest, you're probably going to see a bigger gap in between these two groups than you did looking at overall.
There it is.
You know, so that's kind of looking at what, I don't know who was speaking, but what you were getting at there, that in the higher SES groups, they may just be drinking less overall. So,
just for curiosity's sake, what explains the sawtooth and all these?
So the sawtooth is an artifact of the data. So we have drinking around conception, drinking around enrollment, and drinking around conception is only 1 week's worth of data. So we have 7 days worth of drinking habits, but the drinking we recorded around enrollment is actually 2 weeks worth of data. So instead of just kind of summarizing that into 1 week, where we just, you know, average the 2 weeks and then we kind of repeat that over and over again, we wanted to, you know, have that data where we alternated back and forth from week to week. So that's kind of the artifact of the data that you're seeing, that we have 2 weeks worth of data around enrollment, and we just didn't want to summarize that into 1 week to lose that data.
Variability.
I have a quick question.
Yes.
Alan and Tina, would it be feasible to partition the biomarkers by things like SES? So there may be, it may be that adding biomarkers might predict better under some conditions but not others, for example.
Absolutely. And so I think the understanding exactly that you might expect that would be the case. The other thing is recognize that these alcohol exposure trajectories are an extrapolation from the data that we did have. So we took the week around conception and assumed that women drank that much until they knew they were pregnant. And then we took the date of recognition of pregnancy and considered that what women drank the 2 weeks prior to enrollment, that they drank that from date of recognition to the time of enrollment. And then we use the third trimester measure to extrapolate back to enrollment to cover the full 40 weeks.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Now, is Mike Setti on the line?
Hey, Ed, this is Dale. I'm sorry I came on late.
Oh, okay. No problem.
My apologies.
No problem at all. Mike Setti, if you're there and it says you're online, I just want to let everyone know and congratulate Mike on, first of all, having a baby, and second of all, it's now Dr. Setti.
Hey, congratulations.
That's great.
Congratulations.
I don't know if he's there on the phone, but he's certainly online. So... he just hasn't responded to anything. And
who are you referring to, Ed?
Maybe he didn't realize he has to dial in.
Ed, who are you referring to?
Mike Setti.
Oh, Mike, okay, yeah. This is Dan. I came on late, too. Sorry.
Got it. I'm just chatting with him. Congratulations on the baby and the degree from CFAS. We can't hear you.
You'd think he'd show us a three-dimensional picture of her.
He probably fell asleep. Yeah.
And I also, James Reynolds, can he hear us?
Yes, I can hear you, Ed.
Okay. Just want to let everybody know that James is now the newest member of the Science Advisory Board.
That's great.
Another member.
Hear, hear. Congrats, James.
Glad to have you, James.
Thank you.
So hopefully that will open up new avenues of advice, collaborations, and maybe a closer relationship with NeuroDevNet. So I look forward to working with James, and I thank him for agreeing to participate in CFAS. I haven't heard back from Mike, but any other issues or concerns? Dale, I did mention something about the carryovers in future revisions of CFAS, which I knew was something that Bill wanted to bring up. But he can tell us when he's on the phone next time.
Yeah, he would be the best person, not me, but and he just happens to be out of town as we speak for spring break with his kids.
He's watching baseball as we speak. So
yes.
He'll be back next week, though, right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I got a surprise for him. Let's see, what else do we have to discuss today? Jennifer, any comments, requests, news, or anything we need to know about? I guess not. Or I'm on mute or something. But
no, I can hear you.
We can hear you, Ed.
All right. I think we must be having audio problems because Jen was on a little while ago and now she's gone.
She had to step out real quick.
That Jill sent a doodle call to reschedule April or?
Yeah, if you go to the conference call email, there's a whole list of items for you guys to do. Reminders, and it's one of the reminders and a request for you to do things.
Okay, great. Oh, I see it. Thank you. Sorry. We'll do that.
Okay, and are there any other issues that need to be brought up by the Science Advisory Board?
None for me.
None for me.
None for me.
I'm good.
Oh. Ed, I've got a very... Well, go ahead, Dale. Very minor. I was looking up the website for CFAS, and I think I came up with CFAS 2, and I was wondering if we need to have multiple sites. There might be a reason that they're both living on the internet, but
where's Jennifer?
It may not be a problem, but...
Dale, did you go to cfas.org?
Maybe I didn't do it that way. I'll try.
We'll mention it to Jennifer when she comes.
Jennifer just walked back in, and this is Jill, and we do keep an archive, but if you click on cfasd.org, it should bring up the most recent site. So you just might have the cache saved in your computer that it might just be bringing up that page.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I said to step away for a second. This is Jennifer.
Yeah, right.
So Dale,
now it's got the new page on there.
Okay, great.
When you go to cfas.org.
And if you click on the research tab, you can see all the phases, all the three previous phases and the current phase under the research tab. So it is still available, but it should come up with the news when you just type in cfasd.org.
Okay. Yeah, we often refer people to the site, and I just wanted to make sure I was directing to the right place. Yeah.
You might have had the older site bookmarked because I do think it changed.
Yeah, I'll look into that. That's probably what it is.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right, any other issues?
This is Christy Petrenko. I have a quick question.
I wanted to bring up your issue.
Go ahead.
She sent out an email today, and if anyone knows the answer to that question, that would be great. But Christy, why don't you give it 2 minutes and see if anyone knows what to do right off the bat.
Yeah, I have a question relating to clinical trials. Given that our project has the clinical trials in year 3 through 5, and the progress report, it asked if you have a clinical trial, and I put yes. And I'm getting an error because I need the clinicaltrials.gov number, but we won't have that done until year 3 when we go to do the trial. We don't have enough yet to create that trial. So I'm trying to figure out what, if there's somewhere else I should document that. And then also the inclusion report is all set up for our trials, year 3 through 5. And so I just wanted to confirm that I don't need to fill out that. So those are just the two things related to clinical trials.
Christy, this is Sarah. I think I had asked Bill a question about clinical trials, but he's out, so he might be able to help you. But also Jeff might have a good idea. But I would, my opinion would be that you would say no.
Yeah, I agree.
I would say the same thing.
Until
even though
the
put no until the progress
until
report
you
for that year comes.
Exactly.
In.
Exactly.
The only thing is, like, in the system, it's documented as a clinical trial now, I think.
Well, then you should have
it. It's not running yet.
Okay, so I'll put, I think.
But
or
no.
Just make up a number.
I like the way you think there, Joe.
And
Christy, this is Jeff. One other thought. You could actually create the registry entry in clinicaltrials.gov and then just have it pending. You know, the start date would be pending. That's a bunch of work probably to do before April 1st, but that's another option.
And you can put in only partial variables and then edit it. but you don't want to activate it. Right.
Yeah. Okay, that's an avenue. Maybe putting no for now and getting that in the pipeline for next year when we have the same problem.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I cut myself off. Sorry, guys. But we have had a couple discussions about the new clinical trial program announcements and other things along that line. And I know when Bill gets back, he'll be looking into one of those. So we'll keep in mind Christie's and the other one that we know about and tie that up and help you understand what is needed.
Okay. So, but for now, putting no is probably the best option, just so it'll submit through the system?
I would think.
I say yes. Yeah. I say no and
like
move on.
Get back until it's
they'll fine. Come back to you if they don't like it.
Exactly.
Okay.
I would do that, Christine. I put notes in, just put notes somewhere that says we'll add the clinical trial information in year whatever.
Okay. Great. Got it.
And I think Michael hung up, but I hope everybody who is participating in the ISPR symposium that Michael's put together has sent them their abstract by now.
Still on, Ed, and they all will have gotten an immediate request for an abstract from the website. It's very easy to submit. It has to be less than 200 words, and most of them have already written their abstract, so it's just a question of getting it on. The deadline's the 12th of April.
Okay. And, Jill, do you have everybody's bio sketch that we need and other support?
Yep, I think we're good.
Okie doke, then.
But I am missing some PowerPoints from the February meeting, so if you didn't put your PowerPoint on Ed's USB drive, please get those to me somehow, and I realize they're big files, so you don't have to send me the slides. You can send me PowerPoints or PDFs.
Jill?
Yeah.
Not everybody knows they have their slides on a computer, and I just put them onto the USB. So you better look at who we have and who we don't have, and then just ask those people who we don't have.
Oh, will do. No problem.
Okay.
And Jill, will you let us know if you still need our slides?
Yeah.
Yep, absolutely.
We'll let you know.
Thank you.
We like to keep a record of those, so they're not distributed freely, so don't worry. Well, okay, then, everybody. Thank
Ed,
you.
Do you have? Can I? Do you? Are you not doing project updates?
Unless
can I make it? Can I just say a couple things?
No, I'm sorry. Yeah.
That's okay. Couple things. We were able to make a change in our decision tree app and website so that we can now upload external data sets. So I'm very excited about that. I upload the variables that are required, and then it comes up with the tree. It does the runs the algorithm and comes up with the results. But we can do that for sort of like a batch, so that's cool. We had a paper we submitted, but it's not a new paper, so I'm not going to talk about that. We had submitted it previously. And then finally, you asked me last week or last month to look at the neurobehavioral tests across project, and we've done that. And one of the things that is apparent is that there's very little age overlap. So we have school age, we have young school age. There's a little bit of overlap between the Ukraine child sample and the neurobehavioral test that Jeff and I are doing. Christy's testing parents and Claire's testing adults. So in terms of age, we have a continuous representation, but not a lot of overlap between projects. And in terms of measures, there is just a little bit of overlap from project to project. For example, we have, you know, IQ assessments across the Ukraine and the Minnesota and San Diego samples. We're doing some of the toolbox measures across the child and adult samples, and that pretty much summarizes the neurobehavioral project across projects or across sites.
Good, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Any questions, or does any other project have any exciting new data to present?
It's Joanne. Not quite exciting new data, except our first paper got a revise and resubmit, and the revisions have been completed, and we're about to resubmit that. So that's exciting news. And Sarah, the neurobehavioral testing will be done similarly in parallel in Vancouver. So I'm
yes.
not sure we're linked into that, or we are already.
You are because you're on the under okay. the Claire list, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yep.
And then,
okay. And
I had one more thing. This is Christine.
Yeah.
So my R34 grant that I mentioned before did get funded a couple of weeks ago, and so I just wanted to check with folks to see if you wanted us to add any of the 2D or 3D facial imaging with our participants and whether the saliva samples are starting. We're going to recruit beginning in the summer, so I just would need to know so I can start getting our human subjects or protocol planning if that's something that people would want.
What's the age?
4 to 12. And we're going to have them come in at three different time points. It's an intervention trial. So
yeah, you sent me the neurobehavioral measures. I did not put them on the my spreadsheet, but I think I'll take a look at them and see where the overlap is, because that's a good age.
I actually updated that this morning. So
okay, can you send?
I put
me
it on
the
Google Drive sheet.
Oh, you did.
Online.
You're awesome. Thank you.
We have the toolboxes overlapped a little bit.
Excellent.
So.
Thank you.
So if people want, like, if we want to have a 2 or 3D pictures, if you let me know what that looks like and what you want me to collect, I can see about doing that. So.
You know, since Mike is not on and Peter's not on, why don't you send Jill an email, and then we can take it from there and get in touch with the appropriate people.
Okay.
All right. All right. Any other?
Let's see, we have the protocol from Mike and Peter, or I can send it to her. The protocol for taking 2D, and I can tell you our language that we use in the consent, if that helps.
Okay. Well, I send it to Jill too, just so that I can interface with the PIs and see if like exactly what they want from my people. But I would imagine that would work. But yes, if you could send that as well, then I'll go ahead and get started on that.
Okie doke. Any other last minute comments? Okay then. Well, I'll thank you. Have a good week. We will be speaking next month, I guess, hopefully. All right, take care and be good.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.